Let's start with our motivation. So from the perspective of this lifetime, a long time could be, well, depending how old you are. When you're little, a long time is a year. When you're older, a long time is a decade. When you're even older than that, a long time increases even more. But when we think of following the path to full awakening, then we have to think in terms of lifetimes and eons and putting forth a diligent effort over a long period of time. And instead of being focused just on the goal of awakening, so we can check it off our list and be done with it, to really focus on the process of collecting merit, collecting wisdom, training the mind, pacifying the mind, cultivating the good qualities. So to shift our sense of happiness from achieving the goal to joy in the process of going towards that goal, joy in the process of being of great benefit to others, joy in the process of deepening our understanding of emptiness. And so having that long-term view, when it's really integrated in our mind, then our days can be really joyful. But if we're focused just on getting the result or getting some result or having some fantastic experience, then practicing the path is going to be a real drag. Because we're expecting something, we're craving something, and not getting what we want fast enough. So I think we need some change in our perspective here so that we can keep going and have a very happy mind while we're at it. So when you think, what could be better than being of benefit of sentient beings? And what could be better than accumulating the causes for full awakening? Yeah, for sentient beings, there's nothing better than those. So let's have that aspiration and be content in our heart to act according to it. So just not too long before the class started, I was asking Venerable Sumten, well, when are they going to finish the two sides of the house? And when are they going to pour the concrete? When is the inspector coming? And when are the trusses going to be put on? And you could see my mind is like, I want that building done ASAP. Yeah. And so then everything becomes, when's this going to be done and when's that going to be done? Okay. And when we're practicing the path to enlightenment, we can't think in that way. And actually, even when building a small residence, you can't think in that way either, because you don't know when the inspector is going to come. You know when you asked him to come, but when he comes, who knows? You know? And you know when the Foswell is supposed to arrive, but when it arrives, then you'll know it has. Yeah? So, it's this whole thing of enjoying the process of it. You know, in terms of building Prajna House, keeping the process going in terms of our Dharma practice going towards awakening, keeping the process going. Yeah. But easing up the mind on, you know, let's just get this done already and enjoying what is going on at the moment. And so that's especially needed if you're practicing the path, because your practice is going to go up and down and up and down. And sometimes it's like, wow, you know, I'm really getting it. And sometimes it's like, oh, you know, and that's just the way it is. You don't know when, you know, they're going to pour the concrete. You know it's coming up, but you don't know when. Yeah, so to enjoy that process. Okay, so I realized last week I was having some difficulty reading because the paper is not white, it's off-white. They went through this process in publishing a few years ago where off-white was the in color. Yeah, but I find it makes it definitely harder to read. So I went to my Kindle version. So I will try reading off of the Kindle version, but we'll see where it goes. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So in the book, we're on page 30. Yeah, the last para. Okay. So talking about the different tenet systems. So, by the way, with the tenet systems, the way we hear about them in the Tibetan tradition, they're all kind of, you know, okay, the Vaibhashikas believe this and Satantrikas believe this. Everybody, it's like they have their own catechism. But I think at the actual time in India, yeah, there were just many people who were debating all sorts of different views. And they may have grouped together, you know, and called each other different names, but or called themselves different names, or done both. But I don't think it was so hard and fast in ancient India, because Buddhism was really evolving that time, you know. More sutras were coming to light and being spread. New ideas were there. People were debating things. You know, it was really quite alive and developing. Yeah. In Tibet, once Buddhism went to Tibet, they received so much information that they had to have some way of organizing it. So they chose one prominent way, is according to the tenet system. And so some of the names of the tenet systems that you find in the Tibetan rendition, you also find those names were used in India, like Yogacharya or Madhyamaka. But also some that you find in the Tibetan system, you know, it doesn't, we don't really know if they were used in India or not, okay? For example, the Tibetans, for the lowest tenet system, the Vaibhasika, they say that all of the early 18 schools were subdivisions of the Vaibhasika. According to modern scholars and also according to the Pali tradition, yeah, Pali tradition never heard of Vaibhasika. Yeah, and modern scholars say, and it makes more sense, that the Vaibhasikas are a split off from the Sarvastivadins, who were really, really prominent in northern India. And the Vaibhasikas were a branch of those that based their teachings on this one text called the Vaibhasa. Yeah. So in that case, the Vaibhasika would be a branch of the Srivastavada, whereas the Tibetans usually have the Shravashtavada being a branch of the Vibhasaka. Okay? The Tibetans, when they made it into this tenet system, and not all of the Tibetan traditions actually have the same definitions for these tenet systems. Yeah, there's some difference in the definitions of what they of them and in what they say they believe and so on and so forth. But in Tibet, the tenet system organization is used as a pedagogical tool to help you learn material. Okay, so you learn, here's, you know, what the Vibhasaka, here's what the Svatantrika, here's the Yogacarya, here's the Madhyamaka. And so they organize the material like this so that you start out with the Vibhasaka, which is actually a branch of the Sarvastivada, but don't tell them that. You know, you start out with that. And you learn that because that view is probably the one that's closest to what we naturally believe in our life, how we think things exist. So we learn that. We look at the world through that eyes. Yeah. And that involves already negating, refuting some of the beliefs that we already have. Because at the Vibhasaka, they're refuting a permanent, unitary, independent self. They're refuting a self-sufficient, substantially existent self. So already that's challenging our ordinary view. But they don't assert a selflessness of phenomena. And so according to them, all these things basically exist the way they appear to us. So we learn first, you know, to refute some kind of wrong view on the person. It's of course selflessness, but already it's really challenging how we see ourselves. Then we go on to the Svatantrikas, learn that view. Yeah, try and think like the Svatantrika, because the Svatantrikas are refuting some of the things that the Vibhasakas accept, so it makes you think some more. Well, I learned that. That made sense when I was a Vibhasaka. Now these people are saying that's wrong. Why? What are the reasons for saying that that's wrong? And what do I really believe? Okay. So it makes you think. It challenges you. Okay. Then going on to the Chittamatra, the same way, you know, because those first two schools don't assert a selflessness of phenomena. Chittamatras or Yogacaryas do. So then you have to think, oh, it's not just me. You know, my idea of myself is incorrect, but my idea of how the things in the environment and even my aggregates, the internal phenomena like my aggregates, how my view of those things is incorrect. So that takes you another step, you know. Then when you get you kind of master that. You see things like a Chittamatra. Then they shift you again to the Madhyamaka view. Okay, and then within the Madhyamaka, there's the Svatantrikas and the Prasangikas. And actually that difference, what did not, it was vaguely noticed in India, but it did not become a prominent difference until Jay Rinpoche unpacked it. Yeah. So the system is very much set up to help you keep investigating and looking at how things exist. So we're going to talk a little bit about the, you know, he's bringing this up in the introduction right now, the different systems. And what we're going to be learning in the book is according to the Sao Tantrika system. So that's the second school, okay? And that's because most of the, it was taught in the situation of most of the people who taught it were also teaching the Sao Tantrika view. Okay, so that's why this view is taught in that context, okay? Some of the things you could probably teach according to the Madhyamaka view, yeah? But here, the texts that came to Tibet, you know, based on Dinaga, Dharmakirti, and so on, were mostly taught from the Sao Tantrika view, even though they say Dharmakirti was actually a Chittamatra. This gets a little bit confusing. Yeah. So we won't go into all of that, otherwise you'll pull out your non-existent hair. Okay. You know, for example, the Vasubandhu wrote the Abhidharmakosha according to the Vaivasika view, but he wrote his auto-commentary on the text according to the Sautantrika view. But they say he was actually a Yogacharya. Okay, now why was he teaching according to the lower systems when he was a Yogacharya? Well, they say because at first he didn't believe in the Yogacharya view and refuted it. And after he was converted to the Yogacharya view to purify his negative karma of refuting it, he then wrote the Abhidharmakosha according to the Vaivasika view, which is a lower system. Which makes you ask, well, wait, if he just got converted to the Yogacharya, why didn't he write it according to the Yogacharya view, which is what he really believed in? So then the way to explain it is, well, he was actually a bodhisattva writing for the people who were of that thing. I don't know. But, you know, this is, yeah, how it's set up. Okay? Because we're starting off, our first sentence here is, since there are several tenet systems, so that's where my introduction came from. At its best, Buddhism is not a tradition in which you learn just the assertions of your own school and put them forth. Okay? Rather, at its best, this is the story of the evolution of your own view. Okay? So it's not that you learn, you know, well, I'm a prasangika, so I just learned that and put that forth. Yeah. But rather, you start training in the lower schools, as I just described, so that your own view can evolve. Because as you go from one school to the next, it challenges you to think deeper about how things exist. Okay? So what is the sense of calling a tenet system an established conclusion if it is not final and definitive? Good question, isn't it? It is because that view is final and definitive for the one who has settled on it. So at the beginning, we settle upon Vaivasika view, then we go to Satantrika view, and so on. Okay. It does not necessarily mean that the person will never abandon that view, but for now, that person thinks it is final. Okay? So in the same way, our view will progress. So the Buddha says, for yogis, he has tenets. He is indicating that the serious practitioners are those who have gone beyond just needing advice and now seek settled conclusions. I was going to say settled confusions, which is actually more accurate when you're studying it. Okay, Buddhist reasoning and debate grow out of this investigation into the nature of reality. And it's quite interesting, you know, to see how each system has a different view of the nature of reality and how, as you think deeper, how that view of the nature of reality affects how it sets forth the path and how it sets forth the result of the path, that these things are all intertwined. Okay. In the scholastic literature of Tibet, philosophical tenets are explained in three areas: the bases, the paths, and the fruits. These are the existent bases of reality, the paths leading to a state of freedom, and the fruit of the practice, the attributes of those who are progressing on the path to freedom. In this course, we pretty much look only at the bases. Okay, the introduction to Buddhist reasoning and debate is explained from the point of view of the Buddhist philosophical tenet system known as the Sutra School Following Reasoning. Okay, there's also the Sutra School Following Scripture. Okay, so the Sanskrit term is Sautantrika. This system of Buddhist thought asserts that there are truly existent external phenomena. Okay, so as we know, because we are lofty prasangikas, that's a wrong view, even though we grasp onto it in our day-to-day life, we think it's a correct view. Okay, so it's taught, you know, in a simpler mode that corresponds to kind of how we already see things. Okay. Though the Tibetans do not consider the Sutra School to be the final and highest tenet system, it is the place to begin, for it is easy to see that it describes the way the world appears to be. Yeah, so it challenges us, but not too terribly much. Okay. Also, for the vast majority of assertions on the basis put forth in the Sutra School, the other Buddhist systems do not disagree with them, except in their refined descriptions of the way in which these things exist. So the whole division of phenomena that comes in the Sutra School, or, you know, is pretty much the way the Prasangikas hold it too. So you learn it in the Sutra School, it follows you up to the Prasangika. When you learn about, you know, reliable consciousnesses, you know, and generating non-deceptive awarenesses, you learning according to the Sautantrika, but the Prasangika assert it in a different way. So there's going to be some, you know, you have to think about it, you know, why they change these positions. You may wonder, if they do not consider the Sutra School to be the final and highest system, why don't they just go immediately to the view they do consider the highest and focus on that? Good question. Yeah, I think the answer is that it is a graded path of learning. You start where you are, and according to all appearances, there is a truly established external reality, right? The way we look at things, you know, you look at me, I'm an truly established external reality. That's the way I look at you. You know, we all agree on that, and that's why we don't get along very well. Because it's a wrong view, okay, which causes anger and attachment to arise in our minds. But we agree in our wrong view. Isn't that strange? We agree on the wrong view, which has the effect of making us disagree, because that wrong view gives rise to attachment and anger. Apart from serious training and investigation, who would hold a view as it is found in the Chittamatra tenet system, that all that exists is of the same nature as your own mind and not actually external as it appears to be? Okay. So who, without having studied anything, would think like a Yogacharya, that everything is the same substantial nature as your mind? Yeah, unless you really think about things philosophically, that's not the average person's way of looking at stuff. Okay. The process begins with an analysis of what is at hand, colors, sounds, tastes, and so on, and draws a distinction between what appears and that which apprehends what appears, one's own consciousness. From there, the graded path of analysis goes through several conflicting descriptions of what exists and how it exists. Only then can a person begin to understand and appreciate what the Tibetans generally considered to be the final established conclusions. Okay, so only when you've really studied, you know, some of these incomplete or incorrect systems can you really appreciate the highest view. Yeah, does it really make sense to you? Thus, in this course, the description of basic Buddhist ontology, perceiving consciousnesses, the person, and so on, is made from the point of view of the Sutra school following reasoning. This particular explanation of the Sutra school is drawn from a genre of literature referred to as the collected topics of reliable cognition. Thus, in this book, I will often say, in the collected topics tradition, da 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 da. Okay? So I think the collected topics, it's called Dura in Tibetan. I think these texts were compiled by the Tibetans to introduce the baby beginner to this whole view of what phenomena exist and what are reliable consciousnesses and so on. Yeah. So I don't think they had the collected topics texts per se in India. I think these were, you know, a Tibetan thing. The collected topics texts are so called because of being presentations of assorted central points collected from many Indian Buddhist sources. Yeah, so they didn't just take one. It isn't a teaching on one Indian text. They took material from different texts and compiled it. Kind of like cliff notes, you know, so you don't have to study everything and then put it together in your own mind. They present it in a digested way already. Okay, they draw their information and style of reasoning, especially from the works of Dignaga, who lived in late 5th, early 6th century, Dharmakirti, who lived in the 7th century, and Vasubandhu, who lived in the 4th century. Yeah. The topics collected by Tibetan authors, yeah, here it is, Tibetan authors, are what they see as essential introductory material for those seeking to learn Buddhist logic and epistemology. Rather than being a single work, the collected topics of reliable cognition refers to any number of debate manuals written in Tibetan, okay, so it is, yeah, definitely Tibetan invention, for the sake of introducing new students of Buddhist philosophy to a wide range of topics presented within a rigorous logical framework. Having completed the collected topics, a student is then able to study and understand the higher topics of Buddhist philosophy. Okay, so it's an introductory text. This is the first one that the little kids learn. Yeah, so you have to pretend that you're a little kid. Although debate has been a part of Tibetan Buddhism from the beginning, since it was inherited from Indian Buddhism, and although it is presented in every sect of Tibetan Buddhism, the point of view of this book mainly follows teachers of the Gelupa order of Tibetan Buddhism. Okay, so it's important to understand that all of the Tibetan traditions, Nyingma, Kargyi, Gelu, and Sakya, all have debate. Okay, some of them emphasize it more than others, but it's contained in all of the Tibetan traditions. Okay, and then Dan continues, I worked with teachers from the Gelupa order while still in graduate school at the University of Virginia during research travel in India and in the years that followed. All this was set in motion by the efforts of Professor Jeffrey Hopkins, who established the program in Buddhist studies at the University of Virginia. And this was really, I mean, Jeffrey's incredible kindness and achievement in his life is setting up this Buddhist studies program. And it produced many, I would say that, you know, many, many, many of the people who are now teaching Tibetan Buddhism in U.S. Universities. Yeah, so he had a major influence on how Buddhism was come to be studied in Western academia. And his students are all really top-notch. And they're the ones who are involved now, many of them, not all of them, in the UMA program to translate Jamyam Shepa's works. So they all, you know, they stick together, you know, and you can see they all really love and respect Jeffrey. When he turned, I think it was 60, they did a volume in commemoration of his 60th birthday, you know. So there's, yeah, it's nice how much they respect him and how, you know, they mutually support each other. Because I know when Dan Perdue died, remember Jeffrey was telling us, I think Dan left his house to the UMA Institute, yeah, so that it could work and prosper and things like that. So people really believing in what they're doing. Although I have discussed these topics with and asked questions of scores of Galupa teachers and ordinary monks, I would point especially to three of them. My first Tibetan teacher of Buddhist reasoning and debate was Lati Rinpoche. Beginning in 1976, for a period of about 15 months, Lati Rinpoche taught at the University of Virginia as a visiting lecturer in the Department of Religious Studies. This was incredible. 1976. Lati Rinpoche is a very highly respected Tibetan Lama. And they got, and so is Dhimma Locho, and you know, the ones that follow, and they got them here to teach at UVA, teaching the elementary Dura text that they teach to the little monks in India. Okay? Of course, I'm sure that the UVA students asked a lot of questions that, you know, they had never heard from the little monks. Lati Rinpoche generously instructed us in the procedure and debate, explained the topics, and supervised our practice sessions. Lati Rinpoche was something of a joker and had a playful energy. He would give us an answer or tell us something and then stand back and sort of leer at us and laugh. Geshe Sona Rinpoche did the same thing. Yeah? The more confused they got us, the more, the happier they were. Because that makes you really think. Okay? We would not know whether he was saying it straight or not. Yeah, because he would make a statement. And is he telling us that how it is? Is he giving us the conclusion or is he giving us the wrong view? And, you know, as Westerners, just tell us the right answer. You know, give us the conclusion so we can memorize it and spew it back on a test. And that's not the way debate works. Yeah, they really want you to figure it out yourself. Mm-hmm. When we went wrong, he would give us unwanted consequences of our views. And then you kind of go, ooh, I was wrong. If we figured out the first one, he would give us another wrong answer. Okay, this style is part of the traditional way of teaching debate. You have to be able to think on your own. Of course, when Lati Rinpoche would see that we were stuck, he would explain the matter and his answers were always full. He was one of the very few Tibetan teachers I have ever known who could lecture in the style we are used to here rather than just giving explanations from a text. Okay, so it's very interesting, you know, in Tibetan Buddhism, in when you're studying here like this, it's you have to learn to think on your own. Yeah, In terms of Tantra, it's follow the advice of your Lama. So here you have within one system, and not even in Tantra, also in Mahayana, you know, you have two different things. Think on your own and follow the advice of somebody who knows better than you do. Yeah, and we have to learn how to incorporate both of those things into our life. Okay, some of us, we don't want to think on our own. Just tell me what to do, I'll do it. Tell me the right answer, I'll spit it back and I'll believe it. Yeah, others of us are, don't tell me anything. I don't want to hear any dogma because everything from religion is dogma. So I'm just going to figure this out by myself. And don't tell me what to do because I hate authority. Yeah? So others of us are at that extreme. Okay? Who of you are at the just, you know, tell me what to do and tell me the correct answer extreme when you look at your lives? Yeah? Who of you are at the don't tell me anything, I don't want to hear it? Yeah? So here we are, you know, having to integrate two different things into one person, ourself, to know when, to figure out when do I need to rely on somebody else. And when do I need to think on my own? And how does relying on somebody else and think on my own, how can they be compatible and not make me crazy? Yeah, and actually you see that they have to be compatible and not make you crazy, because what does make you crazy is when you're at either of those two extremes. When you're the extreme of, I don't want to think, just tell me what to do and tell me the correct answer, then you get so confused when somebody asks you to think for yourself. You can't make a decision for yourself. Should I do this? Should I do that? This? What about that? It drives you crazy, doesn't it, when you're at that extreme? When you're at the other extreme of, don't tell me what to do, and don't tell me anything, just give me the material, I'll figure it out, then again, you go totally crazy. Yeah, because you're so, like, independent that even people try and help you, you won't listen to anything, so you get stuck in all your own views and quarrel with everybody, because everything becomes an ego issue, you know? Instead of wanting the truth, you just want your own way. Yeah, so do you see how, you know, we have to be able to combine these in a healthy way. Otherwise, either of these two extremes, we are not a complete person and we drive ourselves and other people nutty. Yeah, so it's an interesting thing to look at yourself, yeah, and see, you know, and learn to ascertain for yourself, when do I need to ask and when do I need to figure out on my own? Because otherwise, again, we'll spend a lot of time getting mad because we want our teacher to tell us what to do and they don't. We get mad at them. Just tell me what to do. I can't make a decision. Tell me what to do. They won't tell us what to do. Or we don't want to be told what to do. And they tell us what to do. Oh, is this my... Are you thinking I'm a teenager again and you have to boss me around? You know, and we go back into that. Yeah. Neither of which is very helpful, is it? Yeah. Because we have to learn, you know, when do we listen to advice and when do we learn to think for ourselves? And when do we listen to our advice and learn to think for ourselves at the same time, so that we understand the advice we're given and we don't just act like dumb robots. Okay, so it's interesting. And this is part of the challenge of learning the Dharma. Yeah. This part of the and we want somebody to tell us when to just accept the advice and when to think on our own. Just tell me that. Or don't tell me when to accept it. Do you see what I'm getting at? Yeah? In 1978, after Lhati Rinpoche had left, Dema Lhotse Rinpoche, again, very well-respected Lama, came to UVA. Rather than teaching from a text, he gave a summary view of the whole of Tibet of collected topics, teaching from amazingly detailed memory and a surpassing grasp of the material. He explained the procedure and content of debates and revealed the level of complexity that can be brought to even the most introductory material. That's the quality of a good teacher. Lhotse Rinpoche was renowned for his abilities with memorization. He said that as a child, before he began his formal study of collected topics, he memorized about half of the 400 pages of the Rato collected topics by Jamyang Khunchok La Ose, Chokla Ose, which his teacher was going to use for the instruction. In India, I met Kenzer Yeshe Tupten and studied Buddhist reasoning and debate with him. Unlike the other two Gelupa teachers I have mentioned, Kenzer Yeshe Tupten was not a found reincarnate lama, but a good monk who rose through the ranks and became a scholar practitioner of the highest order. Yeah, so this brings up the whole discussion in Tibetan Buddhism about tulkus, people who are identified as incarnates versus those who are ordinary monks and who work their way up in the system. His Holiness, well, first of all, in old Tibet, there weren't so many tulkus. There were just a few of them, yeah. And it was a way of assuring that very excellent masters got a good education when they were young. It was also a way of passing down property because the very great masters would have their own house. They would get a lot of offerings. When they died, you needed some way to pass it on. So it was to the incarnates. In exile, what's happening is, and especially since Westerners got involved, so you have these Geshis, you know, who are really good scholars and practitioners who work their way up through the system. And when they pass away, now everybody wants to find their reincarnation. So you have this explosion of tulkus, yeah, of people who, because in old Tibet, they didn't identify the incarnations of all the Geshis. But now, especially in the West, you know, they want to do that. They identify the child. The child gets all sorts of Western toys and different things. And it has an effect on them that I don't think is so good. Okay? But His Holiness is stuck in a position where when people come to him, he has to identify this. His younger brother, Ngari Rinpoche, who himself is an identified incarnation, Ngari Rinpoche says we should just get rid of the whole system altogether. Yeah, because not everybody who's identified as a tulku is, you know, they're, tulku means emanation body, like they're a Buddha. But not all of them are Buddhists. Not all of them are bodhisattvas. Some of them are people who were good practitioners. Some of them are people who, through karma of one sort or another, get found and discovered. Yeah, it's an interesting cultural system. You know, none of the other Buddhist traditions or other countries have this thing of identifying incarnates. So there's good parts to it. There's also not such good parts to that system. But in any case here, with Kenzer Yeshe Tupten, yeah, he wasn't identified, but he became a great scholar practitioner through his own efforts in that life. Yeah. So probably, you know, in previous lives, he was a monk and he studied well and but he just didn't get the title this life. It doesn't really matter, you know, because His Holiness also tells us that we're actually too attached to titles and we don't look at qualifications. And he also, sometimes he really blasts the tulkus and he says, you guys are just living on the good reputation of previous lives and that's not sufficient. You need to practice and do something this life. Yeah. And, you know, the whole thing becomes quite difficult because now so many of the tulkus or the geshis are their tulkus, you know, their incarnations are identified and they become monks. And then, and the disciples, especially the Westerners, have so much faith in them. And then the young monk, when they become a teenager or a young adult, they disrobe. And then the Westerners get very confused. You know, wait, this was the incarnation of my great teacher. We gave him the monastic education just like this. And now he disrobed. And what does that mean? And da 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 da. So it's, yeah, so it's interesting. You have to learn to deal with all of this, okay? After I worked with Khenser Yeshe Tupten, so Khenser actually indicates that he was the former abbot of one of the major monasteries, so clearly he was also very well respected. After I worked with Khenser Yeshe Tupten in India, he too visited UVA during 1981-82 and continued to train us in the topics of reasoning and reliable cognition. Like some lamas, Khenser Yeshe Tupten was always very grandfatherly. One Western disciple I met in India said of him that he so clearly showed kindness that he showed you who you are by contrast. Okay, like, oh. Yeah. It was an extraordinary fortune to be able to learn from these great teachers, that is for sure. Yeah. As a result, this course in Buddhist reasoning and debate is based on my study, my experiences with practicing debate, and the words of my teachers. Okay. One of the purposes of debate is to broaden and mature our view so that we see the world more clearly. Our view influences all. We act as we act and feel as we feel because we believe as we believe. If we wish to change how we act and how we feel, we have to change how we believe. Okay? This is very important, you know. If you believe in karma and its effects, it's going to influence how you act and how you feel. If you have a conviction in them. If you have a wishy-washy, kind of karma, it may not affect how you act and how you feel. Okay? Because you're not so clear if you really believe in karma or not. Okay? If you believe that attachment is a defilement that needs to be eliminated, if you believe that, then you will act in a certain way and you will feel in a certain way. If you don't believe attachment is a defilement, you will act in a totally different way. Okay? So maybe one way we can test what we believe is to see if there's a difference in our behavior and what we feel from how it was before we met the Dharma. And, you know, if our actions and our feelings need some upping, you know, some improvement, then to look, too, at what we believe. Yeah? Because, again, if we have this thing of don't teach me anything. I can learn it all by myself. I'm going to take a little bit from this and this and this and this and this, and I'm going to put all these different things together, and that's going to be my philosophy and my practice. Yeah? So if you have that belief that you can construct your own path, then you will do that, and then you will behave and feel according to that. If you feel, you know, if you believe that the Buddha was an enlightened being and you want to study, you know, what he taught, then, you know, your actions and how you feel will differ depending on the having that belief. Okay? If we wish to change how we act and how we feel, we have to change how we believe. Thus, the battleground is always internal. It is a shared tenet of the classical South Asian religious systems that the thing that keeps us bound in a round of rebirth, subject to death again and again, is internal, and that what will liberate us from this bind is also internal. That is, what keeps us bound is ignorance, and what will liberate us is wisdom. This is very different from theistic religions. Yeah? Where a lot of the basis path and result is external to you. You have to do some internal work, but a lot of it is external. Okay? For example, it is the opinion of Mahatma Gandhi and many others that this is the imagery in the Song of the Lord, the Bhagavad Gita of the Hindus. The form of the Bhagavad Gita is a dialogue between the god Krishna, who is the eighth of the 10 full avatars of Lord Vishnu, and his earthly cousin, the prince Arjuna. The setting is a very dramatic one, the battlefield, where the Panjavas and their allies are preparing for battle against an army led by their cousins, the Kauravas. The battle is for possession of the family kingdom claimed by both. Commentators see this setting, a battlefield where a battle between relatives is about to start, as representing the internal spiritual battle that rages in each of us. Correctness of view is part of this battle. Yeah, I believe in Islam, jihad, it has that same idea. In Judaism, the idea of going through the Red Sea, you know, you're going through a narrow place. Yeah, it has a lot of symbolic effect like that. Okay. Buddhist reasoning and debate begins with disassembling what appears to us. Okay, so it begins with you take everything apart. We usually like to build things. Like buildings, you know. But this is, we got to take things apart, okay? Breaking down and labeling everything so that we begin to see appearances and phenomena for what they are, okay? So this whole process that we'll get into of breaking things apart into, you know, internal objects, external objects, objects of the senses, all these kinds of things, at first, it seems like just like a didactic memorization system. But actually, it's very crucial to meditating on the nature of reality. Because when you start meditating on emptiness, you take the way things appear and you really start dismantling and dissecting them and asking themselves, are they this? Are they that? Are they the other thing? You know? And so it's quite important to know what all the building blocks are so you can do this kind of analysis. One way of learning is to build up a quantity of facts so that you will have ready access to many things. Since this is an internal collection, we have governance over these facts, and in time you will also see the pattern in things. If we see that this thing was produced from causes and conditions and it disintegrates in time, and we see that this other thing was produced from causes and conditions and it too disintegrates in time, we will come to see the pattern that all things produced from causes and conditions disintegrate in time. Buddhist debate includes both sides of this process, building up the facts one by one and seeing the patterns. You will find two approaches to understanding in Buddhism, the more rational style and the more intuitive style. Although both of these are found in every region in which Buddhism is practiced, generally, in the practice of Buddhism as seen in India and South Asia, including Tibet, there is a high cultural value placed on an approach that is rational and sequential. More typically, in the practice of Buddhism as seen in China and East Asia, we often see a higher cultural value placed on an approach that is intuitive and holistic. These are differing pedagogical approaches intended to help us reach new knowledge. In the case of the rational and sequential approach, it is as if we are building up something new, something that we have never had before. In the case of the intuitive and holistic approach, it is as if we are revealing what has already been there, but that we did not know. Kind of sounds like the difference between galupas and sobchen, doesn't it? Clearly, the practice of Buddhist reasoning and debate is more on the side of the rational and sequential. When I went to Taiwan some years back to do some interviews to learn about Chinese Buddhism, I met one university professor who was also a Buddhist. Incredible, what I would call a gentleman, you know? And he was explaining to me that in Chinese culture, debate was considered rude. It's confronting other people and saying, you're wrong, I disagree with you. And that would make them lose face. So, you know, in a Confucian culture, everything is to smooth out relationships. Yeah, you go along with things even if you don't agree with them. At least verbally you go along. Then you do what you want. Okay? Yeah. So if you think that Tibetans always go by the debating, yeah, they often will say what they think you want to hear and then do what they want. I think some of you are familiar with that tactic too. Yeah? So I've learned it as well. Sometimes pays off. You know, you don't lie, but you just say things in a certain way. Yeah? And it smooths feelings. Whereas debate, I mean, you know, in Chinese culture, you know, to sit and scream at each other and push and smack your hands and, you know, that's just downright rude, okay? So you see how culture influences how Buddhism is practiced in different places too, okay? What's more, all of these religions indigenous to South Asia say that it is possible for wisdom to arise in each and every one of us. Again, very different from theistic religions, where you can never have the wisdom of the Supreme Being. They hold that we all have the capacity to gain the same realizations as the former great persons in that tradition, and to become the equal of those great persons. For instance, generally, Buddhists say that it is within the capacity of each and every one of us to become a Buddha. This is because we each have the ability to abandon ignorance and cultivate wisdom. Whether you are bright or not, within each of us is fertile ground for the seed of Buddhahood, which the Buddhists believe already exists in every one of us. However, such wisdom arises only as an effect of effort. Okay, underline that part. Yeah, wisdom is not limited to persons who are special by fate or to those of certain class. Rather, it is limited to those who develop it. Okay? So everybody has the potential to develop it. Yeah? This is one, I think, disadvantage of the Tulku system in Tibet, is that it is assumed that they have realizations. And since they were born with realizations, and they have a title that indicates that, then many other people feel, well, then how am I ever going to attain that state? I wasn't born like that. I wasn't identified. How can I become great like these people who are identified incarnates? Yeah. So for some people, that the system works to discourage them. For other people, the system works to encourage them. It's like everything in life, isn't it? Yeah. It has different effects according to who it's affecting. Okay. Then there's the picture of the sheep, right? The following joke, which I call overapplication of the principle, was originally told to me by Professor Bill Norp, who teaches philosophy at James Madison University. It is a joke on philosophers and to a lesser extent on engineers. At a university in America, here's the joke, there were three friends who taught in different departments. One was an engineer, one was a theoretical physicist, and one was a philosopher. Though their fields of study were very different, they all shared a love of single malt Scotch whiskey. They couldn't, like, have something that was... Yeah, something that didn't involve breaking the precepts. You know? What an example to use. Anyway, so they decided to take the single malt tour of Scotland together one summer. Pretty soon, after they arrived, they went out for a hike in the countryside. As they came up to the top of a hill, they encountered a single black sheep. The engineer said, "Huh, the sheep in Scotland are black." The physicist said, "Well, at least one sheep in Scotland is black." And the philosopher said, "Well, at least on one side." Okay. So the philosopher is analyzing it to death. The engineer isn't analyzing enough and making a general assumption. And the physicist is, you know, kind of in the ballpark. I call this joke over-application of the principle in reference to the philosopher's mistake. The engineer did not apply adequate reason and reserve to the evidence. The physicist got it about right, and the philosopher went too far. It is true that we should seek to be rational and proceed on the evidence. However, in simply trying to ascribe the presence of a person, if we were like the philosopher, yeah, we would have to see the whole body, perhaps turning the person around and maybe even taking off their clothes before we could say who it is. For now, the point of the joke is to be aware that we project a great deal based on little evidence. Okay, underline that. It will be helpful to notice what you observe and what you conclude from your observations. How, on the basis of a little evidence, we make a whole big conclusion. Okay. The thing about identifying the person is very interesting. Yeah, on what basis do we look and say Venerable Sultram is there? Okay? On what basis do we say that? Which? The physical aggregate. Yeah, because a body is there. Okay? Yeah. Do we know for sure? Because to have a person, you have to have all five aggregates. If she's sitting there completely still, yeah, not maybe just falling asleep a little bit, do we know that all five aggregates are there? Or are we assuming that because she's sitting here in this room that she hasn't knocked off. Yeah, because I read something or somebody told me a story of being in a doctor's waiting room, waiting for an appointment, and the nurse, the attendant came out and called the next person to come in. They didn't get up because they were dead sitting there waiting for the doctor. Yeah. So there, you know, you see the body, you assume the person's there. Yeah. But that's not necessarily correct.
Some wait times are kind of like that.
Yeah. In the same way, you know, we call somebody and we hear a voice. Or, yeah, we hear a voice. It could possibly be when we say, oh, so-and-so answered the phone. But it could possibly be a recording of so-and-so, and so-and-so's not there. Yeah. So just based on a little evidence, we have a conclusion. Even when we look, and on the basis of the body, we say Venerable Tsultram is there. Are we seeing her whole body? We're seeing an arm and part of a face and hands. Yeah, on the basis of that, we're assuming her body's there. But we're not seeing it. Okay, so it's interesting, isn't it? How, you know, do you have to see every atom of her body to know that the body's there, to say the person's there? No. Yeah. But yeah, we make assumptions just on some evidence. We don't have to know everything about something to know that it's there. Okay. Like if you were in another room and I went like that, you would say there's a gong in this room. You didn't see the gong, you heard it. Okay? Somebody sitting in this room would just look and say there's a gong, but they haven't heard it. Maybe it just looks like a gong, but it can't read, it can't ring. Or maybe for the other person, it wasn't really a gong, it was a computer. Yeah? So that's the end of the chapter, right? Okay. So before we go on, any questions or comments?
Going back to Jeffrey Hopkins and his tremendous influence, I remember when he was here, and then he said this a few times, he will always point out what you've accomplished in setting up the Abbey and what Betsy Knapper has done. Mm. And he'll say of himself that, you know, I've really done not much of anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really is an indicator of someone who's quite humble.
Yeah, he's quite modest sometimes. But you know what I noticed in regards to that? And I had to think a lot about this because I was quite interested in Buddhism in China, especially in the 20th century China. And there were two principal Chinese monks who were involved. There were several of them, but these two principals who were involved in Tibetan Buddhism and bringing Tibetan Buddhism to China itself. One was Venerable Ninghai, and the other was Venerable, we'll say it's Fuxian for right now. Okay? Okay, so Venerable Ninghai, what he did is he studied in Tibet, and he came back to China and set up monasteries, teaching Tibetan Buddhism in the monasteries. Okay? So he established a living Sangha, yeah, that continued somewhat after he died, but of course you ran into the whole Cultural Revolution that destroyed things. And then Let me look it up, his name.
Okay.
Okay. So Venerable Ninghai had established, you know, temples and taught disciples. Venerable Fashen did translations, and he translated an incredible amount of material from Tibetan into Chinese. And then, you know, both of them faced persecution in the, you know, in China as it became communist. I think Venerable Ninghai died before Venerable Fashen. But it made me think, you know, one established a living commentary, one did translation and produced books. And you need both people doing both things. Yeah? So Jeffrey really appreciated what Betsy did, establishing Doma Ling and Tibetan Nuns Project, because that got living people learning the Dharma. And she appreciated him for doing all the translation work, because that gave the texts so that the living people could study those texts. Yeah? So it points out that we need, for the sustenance of the Dharma, we need a lot of people who have different talents and make different contributions, because we depend on all those people for the Dharma to continue in the future. Yeah, one person can't do it all. We try and put it all on His Holiness. Yeah? Yeah? He is able to do so much because people help him. I mean, and also because he's a fantastic teacher and a great leader, and he knows how to inspire people. But, you know, if you could have leadership qualities and be very inspiring, but if you live out in the, you know, out somewhere and nobody knows you, you can't have that kind of influence. So that's one benefit of having the Tulku system, is that if you have people like this who are reborn life after life, you can identify them, and they have some kind of social acknowledgement, so they can have a strong influence from the beginning. That's if they're identified correctly and da da da. Okay. A long answer to your question.
There's the story of the famous debate in Tibet, where somebody from, I believe, a Zen tradition or Chan tradition, debated with a Tibetan and lost. And then that, they decided that which school of Buddhism was going to prevail in Tibet. Mm-hmm. And I always was kind of suspicious about that story, in the way that the school of people that practiced debate won the debate. And the people who didn't think debating was the way to do things lost the debate.
No, I think Ocean Mahayan understood debate, yeah, but and he was willing to debate. And Kamala Shila, he was Indian, he came to Tibet for that, on Chantarakshita's recommendation. Yeah, he might have been more skilled, but I'm sure Ocean Mahayan knew what he was talking about, okay? It's just he was wrong. Yeah, because the way he was wrong is he said all concepts have to be abandoned, which actually is correct. At the end of the path, all concepts have to be abandoned. But he was saying, you start abandoning all concepts from the get-go. Whereas Kamala Shila said, no, you have to use concepts to learn the correct view. And when you have the correct view, then you develop the union of serenity and insight on that. And through that process, then you go from conceptual understanding to direct perception. Yeah, so there was a difference also in not just the view, but how you practice. Yeah, actually, the Tibetans tell the story as if, you know, that debate happened in Tibet. It was also going on in China. Within the Chan schools of China, they were having that same debate. or not, sometimes between Chan and Huayan, you know, some of the other Chinese schools, the same debate was going on. How much do you need conceptual knowledge and how much do you try and just break through with meditation ability? Okay. And so, you know, they really put Hoshang Mahayan in a really extreme view, because Chinese Buddhism nowadays, I mean, they study and they meditate, you know. I think in Japanese Buddhism, there the study is seen as much less important. And, for example, faith in Amitabha is really emphasized. But, of course, there's still study involved because you have to learn about Amitabha to meditate on him. I should add about that debate that they called this monk Hoshan Mahayan. What it really means is Mahayana abbot. So he was identified according to his position. We don't really know who he was. Yeah.
Okay. I was wondering, when you were presenting the rational and sequential style of Buddhism with the intuitive and holistic, seems to me like that what we know now is the Theravada would fit more the rational and sequential, but I was wondering what you thought.
Yeah, well, it depends Theravada where, okay? Because Theravada in the West, you have to see the history here, because you have Colonel Alcott. But you know, I always have trouble saying that name because the way you spell it doesn't have an "a."
It's Colonel, is the way it's spelled.
Yes, yeah, spelled Colonel, but it's pronounced Colonel, like a kernel of popcorn.
Right.
Yeah. So I always get confused on how to say that word because it, yeah. So he was British, and he was one of the people who went to Sri Lanka early on, and or at least in the 19th century, and studied a lot and was extremely taken with it, with Theravada Buddhism, and he presented it to the West as a very rational system. Okay, if you read some of the books, we have them in our library about, I forget the names, but it's about modern Theravada in the 20th and 20th, well, mostly 20th century. You'll see that for the Thai people, actually, for the people who are not monks, there's a great deal of the faith-based stuff, faith in the monks, believing in ghosts, you know, exorcisms, house blessings. There's a lot of this kind of faith-based stuff. Although in the West, due to Colonel Alcott, they like to present it as very rational. Yeah. But, you know, out in the villages, yeah, okay. And then, but then you have, you know, Theravada as it's practiced in Asia, where you have, let's say, Vipassana meditation put right in the context of the four truths, yeah, and right in the context of basis, path, and result. And then you have Vipassana meditation as it's practiced in the West, where it's completely extracted from Buddhism. In many ways, not, you know, maybe a little bit of Buddhism in there, but very much extracted as just a meditation technique. Yeah. So, you know, it's one word can mean a lot of different things and refer to things going on in a lot of different ways and in different groups. Yeah. Tibetan Buddhism, Vipassana refers to all the analysis we do when we're studying emptiness.
Would you say that a balanced practitioner would need both the rational sequential approach to things and also be able to look at things holistically and intuitively?
Yeah, I think it's good to have a balance. And I think it's good to have a balance of, in your practice, of more faith devotional activity and rational study. I think, you know, some kind of balance between those two is very, very helpful in your practice. But each person will have a slightly different balance.
Like, I think I'm very much the rational person, and I really want to focus on, like, developing the intuitive side, because I think I need that balance.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe sometimes I want to go too far.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, I don't agree so much with the word intuitive, because intuitive, it connotes, I just know it because I know it. Yeah. And I don't think that's what he's really referring to. You know, I usually make it between, you know, the rational side and the more devotional, faith-based, trusting in the three jewel side. Because that trust is based on understanding. Yeah. It's more emotional, but it's based on understanding. It's not just intuitive, like, I know it in my heart, kind of, you know, make-believe kind of stuff. Because I think I'm allergic to the word intuitive, because when I look in my own mind, I intuit certain things, and mostly they're wrong. You know? Most of my intuition, you know, I feel like this and that's going to happen, and it doesn't happen. Okay? So that's why I don't like using the word intuitive. Yeah, I prefer more, yeah, faith-based or devotional, because that leaves room for something to be based on understanding, not just blind belief.
I think it comes from the idea that we all have this inner wisdom just waiting to be tapped, kind of like the inner Buddha nature. So if only we can plug into that, then we're good.
Yeah, if only we can plug into it. Yeah. Now, I don't know about you, but like I said, often I plug in, you know, into my inner wisdom, and it turns, you know, when people get, I get a feeling of like this and that's going to happen, it's usually wrong. But often I can think something's going to happen, and I'll predict it correctly, and I can see it's because I know certain facts. And on the basis of certain facts, I make an educated guess. It's not just, you know, yeah, it's not like that, okay?
So from what I hear saying, Venerable, is that devotion only comes from wisdom, and the wisdom only comes from practice. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that devotional and wisdom balance each other. There's an interplay between the two. Yeah? When you're trying to do a lot of study and using rational stuff, sometimes you get so stuck in your head and you can't think clearly, you know, because you're so stuck in a lot of concepts, a lot of this. At that time in your practice, then you need to do like prostrations, mandala offerings, chanting and visualizing light coming into you from the Buddha. Those more intuitive things, those more devotional things, yeah? Then if you do that, then when you come back to your study, then your mind is clear, your mind is soft and receptive. Yeah. If you go to the other extreme and you're doing just devotional kind of things and, You know, you're getting so off on visualizing light and permeating you, and, you know, that's your new high. But you're not thinking about the Dharma. Yeah? Then you need to go more and do some study and reflection to really enhance your visualization process practice so that you understand what you're doing. Okay? So I think, you know, your faith and devotion increases your wisdom increases your faith and devotion, and they go back and forth. And I think practice is both of them.
Maybe you've heard this story about Hashanga and Kamalashila,
mm-hmm.
that Kamalashila had a doubt about whether Hashang would know all the intricacies of debate. Mm-hmm. And as he was approaching on his horse, Kamalashila did some movement. It was something like a shoe over his head. I don't remember the detail, but it was some sign within debate. Anyway, he made some sign, and then Hashang made the correct response, and he thought, oh, good, now we're going to have a good debate because he knows what I'm talking about.
Okay. Oh, I never heard that story. Yeah, that answers your question. That is a good question. Yeah? Maybe Hashang, because he had been at Samye for some years, maybe he spoke Tibetan. But Kamalashila was coming from India. Did he speak Tibetan? And the Tibetan king was the one who was the judge in the debate. So I don't know. That's a very good question. We should ask that to somebody sometime. Yeah? Yeah.
I was thinking about just what I've been exposed to with monastics from China and this whole thing about intuitive or whatever. But the thing I notice mostly is the teaching style of using the great use of stories and metaphors is what I noticed in my experience with at least at Foguanshan when in all the mm-hmm. classes we had. It was really common. And then, like, for instance, one example was, like, they were asking, what is the mind?
Mm-hmm.
And no one in the whole room of 140 people had a definition. It was all similes, metaphors. Mm. And so I kind of...
Yeah.
And that seemed to be... Well, that kind of crystallized one thing I noticed throughout a lot of the teaching. Not everyone's style was that way, but a lot of the styles were that way.
Yeah, interesting. In the Pali canon, you see the Buddha used reasoning and he also used similes. Yeah, and the Tibetans use stories too, if you can understand them. But they did, Aryadeva did too, but you know, if you can understand his stories. Oh, they really puzzled me. Okay, anything else? Yeah.
Yeah. Just quickly, I wanted to let people know that all the recordings of Lati Rinpoche and Dema Lhotse Rinpoche and all these classes are actually on the UMA website.
Ah.
Yeah. I listened to one class with Dema Lhotse Rinpoche and he's teaching all the UVA students how to debate, but he's just saying it in Tibetan and saying, repeat after me, and they're all repeating together and clapping. It's quite cute to hear. Yeah. And one more thing was, Bill was telling us how at that time many of Jeffrey's students felt very strongly that they were trying to rescue Tibetan Buddhism, especially after the Cultural Revolution, like to get those texts out.
Yes.
But he found that now, on hindsight, he felt the greater threat to Tibetan Buddhism was within the academy was coming from Buddhist scholars who did not hold the Buddhist worldview, who are kind of teaching the philosophy separate from it. And that was what surprised him. And I think that maybe that's why it's very important that we have the Buddhist worldview spelled out in this text, in the first two chapters.
Yeah. Bill said he thought, that was Bill who said that?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I mean, back then their mission, they felt, was to rescue Tibetan Buddhism from the Chinese communists. But now he felt, within the academy, he was personally quite disturbed that there were scholars who were kind of teaching Buddhist philosophy as if it didn't fit within a worldview that involved karma, rebirth.
Yeah, looking back on that time. He
felt this is the greater threat, yeah. He felt, to the transmission of Buddhism.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a big threat now too, you know, people who think that they know Buddhism well, but they don't understand the basics and they don't have faith and confidence in it. So it gets distorted.
It's just a comment on that, actually. Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of people who want to extract some usefulness from Buddhism but don't really believe in it.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate the beginning of this book, mm-hmm. how he set it up. And
yeah. Yeah, the going through this, these introductory chapters are quite important. So you see where this whole thing fits and why we're doing it. Otherwise, you know, like you start the debate text and, you know, the white horse is not white. Yeah? And like, what does that mean? How does that, you know, I came here to get awakened and you're telling me white horses aren't white. Yeah, so you have to understand the whole context.